PTZ is supported by My City Scene, the website created by and for the people of Jefferson County, listing local businesses, services, restaurants, and events. Details at mycityscene.com.
I was going to do that all clever and then pop in from the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles theme song to talk to Nat Jacob, but I forgot I had to play a spot. So My City Scene, great spot. Also, Frank De Palma affiliated with the Ninja Turtles, I believe. So if you need to get a hold of them, just give Frank De Palma a call. And now featuring Nat. I always want to call you Nat Danger, but this is not a Nat Danger interview. This is a Nat Jacob interview. So I better get that straight right off.
Well,
the bat.
I'm not so sure after that intro.
Well, you know, you can be serious, but also like party in a suit, right? I mean, that's kind of what you're about.
Well, absolutely. I'm honored, quite frankly. And the Ninja Turtles are a big part of my life, or at least were for my preteen years. So,
and you sent me an email just before we went on, which is every pizza the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles ordered. And then it has a quiz you can take. And just scrolling through it, I'm just amazed that there was a bananas and anchovy pizza and a popcorn pizza.
Oh, yeah, that's not even the worst of them, man. Not even close.
What's the worst, do you think, out of this list?
Oh, I don't know if I would eat an oatmeal pizza.
Well, yeah, that doesn't sound very good. Oh, man. Or marshmallow and guacamole.
Clam sauce and chocolate sprinkles.
What is wrong with the Ninja Turtles? I thought that, well, I guess they are like sewer-dwelling refuse eaters, really, at the end of the day.
Nailed it.
That's a truth about them that I never really took in when I was a kid enjoying the many entertainment value from those properties.
Yeah, no, I don't think you need to write the dissertation on that one. I think you pretty much summed it up.
That's what I'm doing here, is solving the world's problems, helping people understand things that are confusing to me as well, and I'm doing it thanks to you, Nat. So thanks for being here. We've already shed a lot of light on important issues that our Jeffco and beyond listeners need to be aware of.
Yeah, no doubt.
So we've got Nat Jacob here. Nat is an associate attorney at Jefferson Associated Counsel. Is that your main title?
Sure. Yeah.
And you're also on many nonprofit boards, or at least several. And as you know, similar to Justine, also very much an activist in our community for lots of different causes and things that are important.
I'm back on the nonprofit boards. I'm just repping KPTZ now.
Oh, you're just only KPTZ. Oh, perfect. I've got a lot of things to talk to you about offline. Kate Ingram, I'm telling you, she is the greatest.
She is.
Yeah. And she's listening right now. Well, maybe she turned off, but if she did, she missed out on that shout out. And it was genuine, too. So we're talking to Nat today about lots of different things. Nat and I initially started talking about State versus Blake, which if you listened last week and a couple weeks before, we talked a lot about, which is essentially the court ruling that has decriminalized minor possession in Washington state. Was that an effective slug of what State versus Blake did, Nat?
Well, I'd say it decriminalized felony possession of drugs in Washington state. So I take your meaning when you say minor to mean that it's a minor offense from the standpoint of our social lens. But from the standpoint of the law, drugs have long been, indeed since 1971 in Washington state, drugs have been, just simple possession has been a felony. And what this landmark decision did on February 25th, effective immediately, was decriminalize felony possession. Render that statute unconstitutional, which has broad implications. And I know that you got into that with Sam Feinstein last week, so I don't want to go back over all of that. But astounding amount of implications and ripple effects, all positive, I might add.
Yeah,
for the citizens of and taxpayers of Washington.
That's great. And from your state your status as being someone who defends people who may not otherwise have the means to hire a private attorney. How is it affecting your job on the day to day?
Well, yeah, I think there's this myth that it's eliminated our workload or reduced it. It hasn't, because now our work is going to be a lot of kind of going back and correcting the record for people and helping them indeed, you know, vacate their old, you know, crimes that should have never been crimes to begin with under this ruling, and help them out with cleaning up their criminal record. So that's something that we've kind of started doing. There's a little bit of a hiccup in that the ruling isn't officially finalized yet. There's a process that I didn't actually know about until this particular ruling dropped from the Supreme Court. But apparently, within 20 days of the initial decision, which was February 25th, you know, opponents have the opportunity to ask for a process called a motion to reconsider. And that motion was filed exactly 20 days after the ruling. Don't ask me to do the math, but sometime in mid-March by WAPA, the Washington Association of Prosecuting Attorneys. I'm sure that they had some folks join that effort, but they're asking for, at the very least, clarification, if not overturning the ruling itself. And I haven't read their briefs, so I don't have a whole lot of knowledge about exactly what their arguments are. But, you know, this has thrown police officers and departments and county sheriffs and prosecutors for a loop, because it happened kind of out of the blue. Not even the defense bar knew that this was going to happen. And then come February 25th, boom, huge decision. Again, all positive. But, you know, a lot of our work, to answer your question right now, is just kind of trying to wrap our heads around the full implications of the decision and, you know, whether people are going to be refunded money, for instance, that they may have paid on an old drug crime that they an old drug conviction that they got. You know, that's part of it. Indeed, it looks like everyone's going to be able to have their record clear of this particular type of offense, which is great because it's affected the lives of a lot of people negatively over the 50 years that it's been on the books. So anyway, that's hopefully that kind of answers your question.
Yeah, no, that totally does. And going forward, you know, I'd ask Sam and also James Kennedy, who was on earlier, was, you know, can you game out any kind of end result to this? Like, will it end in this sort of being something permanent that's never fixed, or will there be down the line some kind of new legislation or new ordinance or statute that replaces what was previously there?
Well, good question. You know, there's already a legislative effort underway in this current session. As Justine Gonzalez-Berg mentioned earlier, we're in the middle of a legislative session now that's set to end here in the next couple of months. And surprise, surprise, legislators introduced an emergency bill, you know, right after the Blake decision was rendered, saying, you know, we can't possibly have, you know, a free-for-all when it comes to drug possession in our state. So we have to, you know, repair this by introducing a bill that adds literally one word to the current statute in an attempt to make it comply with the court's decision in State v. Blake. And that bill, I don't know I don't have in front of me the number of that bill, but it's farcical from my standpoint, because the 62-page decision in Blake, you know, what it really got into is just the tremendous impact that felony drug possession laws have on people's lives. Mm. And yes, you know, the decision was made based on a set of facts where a woman, you know, essentially was able to prove that she unwittingly possessed methamphetamine in the coin pocket of some jeans that she was borrowing. But the broader point that the court, I think, was trying to make in Blake was that you can't have these laws on the books that basically say, you know, the prosecutor doesn't have to prove anything but just bare possession, and have that have a lasting impact on somebody's life through vis-a-vis a felony conviction that literally is going to haunt them for the rest of their lives. It haunts them in terms of their ability to obtain housing, in terms of their ability to obtain a job. We know these things. I think most people know these things. But there are over 10,000 collateral consequences on the books in the state of Washington, at last count, that trigger when you have a felony. Depending on the different types of felonies. But with a drug felony, there are thousands and thousands of things you can't do. For instance, you can't ever become a tattoo artist in the state of Washington.
What?
If you have a drug felony. You can't become a hairdresser.
What?
Drug felony. Yeah, these are things that people don't realize, but they're true. This is stuff that is reflected in the WACs and in the RCWs of Washington, statutory and administrative codes. So,
is it because you would be such a good tattoo artist after being in prison for a few years that you will absolutely be better than anybody who hasn't been to prison on a felony?
And competitive advantage. Oh, I think it just has to do with, all jokes aside, it has to do with our society's obsession and our legislative obsession over the past 70 years. Since the war on drugs started, officially or unofficially, with penalizing addiction, and with locking people up and taking away their privileges and their rights, quite frankly, as a result of a medical issue. And so, what I'd like to actually move on in the conversation, if I could.
I wanted to relate this back because I know you have a legislative effort that you're really interested in that kind of dovetails with State versus Blake and how. Folks are criminalized unnecessarily.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll put a cap on Blake, and I'll just say this, that if our society and our legal fix to Blake is ultimately to pass a law that adds one word to the statute that's been robbing people of these rights and privileges for the past 50 years and having this negative impact that ripples throughout our entire community, if that's our fix, then we lack a serious amount of creativity. And, we should be talking about things like drugs being a medical issue, drug addiction being a medical issue that should be dealt with by public health appropriately instead of by locking people up and taking away their ability to earn and support their families and, quite frankly, have a house over their head. So that's what I'll say about Blake. And then you're right. Yeah, I do want to move on to something that is very much in my kind of zeitgeist right now, if you want to put it that way, but very much on my mind, and it's timely that we're having this conversation. I want to talk about ending debt-based driver license suspensions in Washington State, a policy that's been on the books since 1993 and has impacted over those years literally millions of Washingtonians. At any given time, 180,000-plus people in our state are have their license suspended based on debt, and that's based on a study conducted by the ACLU a couple years ago called Driven to Fail. I'm glad to answer questions about the current legislative effort, pros, cons, etc. Spoiler alert, the bill in its current form is not good, and I'd love to talk a little bit in more kind of nuance and specificity about that.
Well, so Give us a little background on how, what exactly it means by debt-based license suspension and how that is in play and works against people, I guess, in this case.
Sure. Thanks for the question. So the way this works is in our state, and actually we're quite unique in our region, each state that surrounds us, including Idaho and Montana, typically red states, do not have a law that criminalizes driving with a suspended license for simply being poor, essentially, what we call driving while poor. The way it works is that, let's say you, Paul Rice, run the stop sign right by Aldridge's there on the corner of Lawrence and Taylor.
I've done it.
I did it this morning. Only after the fact. Anyway, you get pulled over by one of Fort Townsend's finest. And they issue you a ticket for a moving violation. And for whatever reason, Paul, either because you don't have the dough or because you just moved and you didn't get the actual citation in the mail or whatever reason, you fail to respond to that citation. Or maybe you do appear, but you don't end up paying on the ticket or creating a payment plan with the court. Whatever the reason, your debt is going to go to collections, ultimately. And when it does, your license privilege to drive in the state of Washington will be suspended. Now, you may not even know that your license is suspended because, again, maybe you moved addresses or maybe DOL just didn't send you a notice, because that happens a lot, too. And, you know, for whatever reason, if you're out there driving again, you know, in Washington, we don't have a privacy right in our license plate number. So you can sit a deputy from the JCSO or one of our fine police officers in town can just sit at the intersection of, you know, SR-19 and Chimicum Road and run license plates literally all day long. And some deputies do. This is like what they do for a living. And every time they get a hit with a suspended driver, they're going to pull that person over and arrest them for driving with their license suspended in the third degree, which is the crime that happens when you drive after, you know, incurring debt and not paying your tickets or whatever. Mm. So that's most commonly how it happens. Now, you can probably see what's problematic about this. And that is that this has no relationship with public safety. It has everything to do with your ability to pay, right? So if you're a driver who needs to get to work and, you know, uses your license to do that, you live in a rural area and don't have access to public transportation, you need to get your kids to school or from school or get to medical appointments, and your driver's license is deprived because of something like this, ultimately because of your inability to pay, you are now a criminal, and you're going to continue to get these tickets, these criminal infractions, we call them, for driving with license suspended third degree every time you drive. Mm. And I have clients who have, you know, dozens and dozens of them on their record. So that's kind of how you get into the system, typically. And then the question is, you know, what should we do and what can we do about this? And so there was a bill that was introduced by a broad coalition, or with the support of a broad coalition of which I'm a part of, led by the Washington ACLU of Washington. Big shout out to them. They're doing really important work in a number of, you know, they've got a lot of fingers and a lot of pies around the state, but this is one of their important efforts. And that bill, which was called SB 5226, I'll say that again for those following at home, SB 5226, was originally designed to end this this insidious practice of suspending people's licenses for unpaid debt. What ended up happening, unfortunately, is as it was leaving the Senate floor, it was literally the last bill to leave the Senate floor, it was packed with an amendment that was introduced by a senator named Cleveland, allegedly a Democrat from Clark County, who it was essentially a poison pill. It allowed collection agencies and courts, or would allow collection agencies and courts, to circumvent this, you know, the prohibition on courts to deprive people of their license for failure to pay. And a lot of compromises had been made to that bill prior to that point that we were, as a coalition, willing to live with. But at that point, it became a bill that was going to do more harm than good. And unfortunately, although it's now gone to the House with that amendment, the House Transportation Committee, I just learned, has failed to remove that amendment or fix it, basically, so that it's now, you know, back to where we started, essentially, which is what we want. We want to end debt-based license suspensions in Washington State, quite simply. And that's not happening with the current version of the bill, which was ESSB 5226.
And is this it's a pretty common practice in the countrywide?
Well, good question. So actually, there's a great website you can look at. It's called freetodrive.org. And that website actually will show you all of the different places that have reformed this practice. Yes, it's true that many states had these types of laws on the books, and some continue to. But there are states, both red and blue, who in recent years have reformed this because they realize that it's a waste of taxpayer dollars. The ACLU study that was performed in 2019 showed that our law in the state of Washington has cost the Washington taxpayer over $1.316 billion since its inception. And that's not a surprise to those of us who work on the ground on this issue, public defenders and prosecutors, because currently this represents one-third of my caseload. People, and I'll say that again, people who are driving with a suspended license due to unpaid debt represent one-third of my caseload at any given time. And I've got over 100 cases that I carry.
Wow.
So if we had a meaningful reform to this issue, one that didn't include the Cleveland Amendment, we could wipe away that one-third of every public defender's caseload statewide, ostensibly, overnight. And that means that the prosecutors are carrying less of these dinky cases that I'm pretty sure anyone who's listening to this who doesn't know about this issue is probably astonished and I should hope, like, upset about the fact that this is something that we do. And it's just kind of the standard operating procedure, especially in rural counties like ours, which sucks because we don't have access to meaningful alternatives to transportation than driver's licenses. So, you know, driving licenses should be a right for us. Instead, it's a privilege, which is why they can take them away with a wave of a hand because a collection agency or a court wants them to. So, you know, obviously I'm very passionate about this issue. I think it's a real no-brainer, but unfortunately the collection lobby is strong. The dark side is strong, and they've been able to really manipulate would-be Democrats into joining Republicans. We always knew Republicans were probably going to oppose this just because of how much they, you know, are supported by and in turn support industry over people. But what we didn't expect is that there would be Democrats that would join them in really kind of watering down and ultimately destroying the promise of ending debt-based suspensions in our state.
Well, maybe,
and that's a real disappointment.
I could see legislators, especially certain Democrats that may kind of consider themselves moderate, saying, hey, here's an easy way for me to score points and look like I support law and order on an issue that most people don't actually understand. Like, I didn't really think about it until you started talking about it today.
Paul, you just nailed it, man. You've got good instincts. That's exactly what's going on. That's what we think. I mean, watching some of the floor debate on this issue is enlightening because there are people who are supporting this bill in its current form who want us all to think that they're doing us a favor. And I'll just go ahead. I'll kind of crib on something that you mentioned at the start of your show about an hour ago, which is that, you know, you hinted at the fact that we were going to be talking about issues that deal with, you know, disproportionate impact on communities of color and younger people, et cetera. This is, surprise, surprise, I know it's going to be shocking, but this is a law that is very disproportionately applied and disproportionately impacts communities of color. And you'll see that in the study that I keep referring to, the Driven to Fail study from 2019. You know, this will be a shocker, too. It disproportionately impacts young people. In fact, in the sample years that were included in the study, fewer than 1% of the arrests that were made for driving with license suspended third-degree crimes affected those 60 years or older. Fewer than 1%.
Wow.
I don't want to bury the lead either because the statistics are complex. But when you look at them, it's very, very clear that communities of color, particularly African-American communities, get the shaft when it comes to the application of this law and also all of the secondary effects. We know these communities are more likely to experience poverty. And, of course, this law, as I said at the top of the hour, doesn't just disproportionately impact people without or limited means, but it exclusively impacts the poor. Because if you're Paul Rice and you've got money to pay your moving violation, you're never going to be impacted by this,
right?
Period.
Right.
You might not even know that this is a criminal offense, right? You'll just go and pay your license and get your license back. And that's that. Well, right.
And it's interesting, right? Because I always heard about people say, oh, the kid got pulled over for suspended license and then they found drugs and then they, you know, found a weapon or whatever else. So
and that's their game.
Right. It's like using the simple possession case to bring it into something else or a different kind of a charge. It's almost a means of leverage.
Well, and to tie this together with the Stevie Blake discussion, I mean, you're absolutely right. You know, these are two real easy ways for the police to justify their own existence in our communities, to justify their ever-expanding influence over our communities, and to justify the harm that is being done to our communities, particularly communities of color and younger people in our state. And it's through this, you know, pretext of stopping people for the big bad, you know, violation of driving with your license suspended in the third degree, and then, you know, poking around in their business and trying to find out if they're using drugs or if they got something else illegal on board. It's, you know, it allows them to do essentially a freebie search. And so if it goes away, the positive implications of that are not just that it's going to eliminate the, you know, the criminalization of poverty in this instance, but also that those communities, that's one less arrow in the cops' quiver to continue to harass these communities. Now, I'm not making a blanket statement about all police officers. In fact, the Port Townsend Police Department decided to stop pulling people over for driving with license suspended about a year and a half ago, and it's been effective. They haven't been doing it. Ironically, the only arrests that have been made in our city limits have been by JCSO officers that have just been encroaching and making arrests to people occasionally for this type of offense. But, you know, each week I get between 15 and 30 new cases, or my office does, that are related to driving with license suspended in the third degree. Wow. And it's just, it breaks my heart, you know, because why should we be hauling people into court and traumatizing them, quite frankly, for being poor.
Yeah. We're talking to Nat Jacob here on Filter, KPTZ 91.9 FM. Nat Jacob works at Jefferson Associated Council, but also we're really talking about an issue that goes beyond and has implications countrywide, driver's license suspensions, and kind of understanding something that I think a lot of us had no idea was such a huge problem. So before we talk any further, Nat, you brought us a song today. I want to have a little musical interlude, wondering if you might introduce the next musical guest.
Yeah, so this is a song very near and dear to me. Every time I hear it, I actually think of these issues of criminalizing poverty because it has a line that's spot on, and I'll talk about that afterwards. But it's by the band, the late great band, and it's called "The Shape I'm In." I'm sure many of you have heard of it. It's from the album "Stage Fright" from 1970. So take it away, Paul.
This is David Cunningham for the KPTZ Emergency Response Team with an important announcement about your safety. In the event of a major earthquake that could produce a tsunami wave in Puget Sound, the Department of Emergency Management will activate warning sirens in Jefferson County coastal areas. If you ever hear a siren like this, that means you should prepare for possible evacuation and tune to this radio station, KPTZ 91.9 FM, for updates.
This is only a test. This is only a test. It's a test of your ability to continue listening to this great radio show, Filter, on KPTZ 91.9 FM. We've been talking to Nat Jacob about debt-based driver suspension, and he played us a song from the band, The Shape I'm In. And I think there was a particular line in there that really corresponds to what we've been talking about, Nat.
Well, first of all, I want to give a shout out to that warning sound because it sounds pretty whimsical to me.
Should we listen to it again?
like a kazoo that I gave to my daughter.
Can I just play it by clicking? I'm going to get in trouble.
This is David Cunningham for the key.
I thought I could just play it. Yeah. Oh, go ahead. I was trying to get in trouble.
The line that you're mentioning from that song, The Shape I'm In from the band, is I just spent 16 days in the jailhouse for the crime of having no dough. Now here I am back out on the street for the crime of having nowhere to go. And I love that line for a number of reasons, but mainly because it really kind of ties this conversation to the one that you were having with Justine a little bit earlier about homelessness and folks who are underhomed. And I will say that this bill, or rather this effort that's being made by our coalition, a lot of it's driven by what we call affected advocates, folks who, you know, whose lives have been impacted negatively by this law of suspending debt-based driving license, or, you know, debt-based driver license suspensions. And several of them, many on my caseload, have been living in their cars because of the housing crisis that we're all experiencing statewide, but, you know, especially in counties like Jefferson and King, as, you know, home values skyrocket and the cost of living becomes less and less affordable for working people, people are living in their cars. And so imagine, if you will, the cruelty of depriving somebody of a driver's license because they're poor, and they're living in their car. And I have, you know, these are real examples. I have people who live in the Safeway parking lot or alternately the QFC parking lot and are having to move their cars so that they don't run afoul of the rules of those organizations. And when they move their car, they get pulled over and ticketed with a criminal offense. You know, just for the crime of having nowhere to go, just like they say in the song.
Right.
And, you know, spending 15 days in the jailhouse for the crime of having no dough. I mean, this is literal, right? Robbie Robertson, when he wrote that song, he was talking about a friend who was in the band, Richard Manuel. But also, you know, they were talking about the life on Skid Row, moving from a rural place in America in the 70s or late 60s to Skid Row and not having a place to go and being locked up just for being poor.
Yeah.
And those, unfortunately, here we are 50-plus years later, and that practice has stuck with us. And to kind of highlight a point that you made earlier, Paul, you know, I'm going to just kind of call out moderate Democrats in our Senate and in our House are content claiming the, you know, the moral victory or moral high ground of a watered-down bill that would do very little to help those people, if anything, and may even be more harm than good, and try and take the high ground and say, hey, we're going to end this practice, when they know damn well that that's not at all what they're doing with this bill. And so, you know, we live in a society where you can do that. You can try and claim that credit and get, you know, people to kind of pat you on the back for being a good liberal. But at the end of the day, you're not doing anything to end poverty or to positively impact these affected advocates' lives. And I'm not the one saying that alone. It's a whole coalition of people that includes, you know, 40-plus organizations and a number of people who have been impacted by these laws themselves.
Right.
So anyway.
Yeah, and I mean, I'll go ahead and say it. I mean, folks, so many folks in this new political climate, they legislate, and I mean, it's always kind of been like this, but people aren't legislating or from a point necessarily of wanting to see a change. Their goal is re-election. And, you know, you have these weird gray areas where when you just look at it on its face, you know, debt-based license suspension, I would say, oh, okay, well, that person didn't pay, so, you know, there has to be a penalty. So I guess my question would be to answer those moderate Demo Republicans, like what would be introduced, you know, in order to encourage people, you know, once they're able to pay, you know, whatever the fine is, or you just get rid of the fine altogether and stop penalizing people in this way. I mean, how do you see, well, I hear Charlie Berman in my voice being like, Paul, make a question simpler. And you're right, Charlie, you know, what do you see as an alternative, Nat, to what currently exists?
It's a good question. You know, of course my bleeding heart wants this to just not exist. We shouldn't be funding our systems on the backs of the poor and the most vulnerable in our society. So I think that alone is a moral imperative and should be reason enough to not impose a financial burden for people, you know, who have these issues. But, you know, if we're talking about responding to your average boomer, no offense intended, the average person who has means and doesn't have any, like, a clue about this issue and maybe says reflexively, well, what about scoff laws or what about, you know, there's got to be some sort of price. First of all, no. Why does there have to be some sort of price? And why does that price end up ultimately being, being paid by all of us, not just the people who are imposing the restrictions on? But secondly, you know, let's stop and think a minute about, you know, the actual cost of what it is that we're proposing. If we're going to continue this insidious practice, you know, we're talking about an entire court system, one third of which on a given day is devoted to prosecuting people for this, right? And why? Why? Because we want to teach people an important lesson that if they're poor, they shouldn't be able to speed or run a stop sign. Whereas if they're rich or have enough to pay a ticket, that law shouldn't apply to them. Mm. You know, that to me is unjust because it's an equal protection issue. It's like, why is it that a poor person has to suffer and have this you know, add to their troubles when another person, it doesn't even, you know, doesn't even faze them, right?
Yeah.
That's the nature of this law. And so I'm trying to get it away from this kind of argument about, you know, when you do something, you have to pay, because I think that's an old form of thinking, and it hasn't served us at all in the context of anything from, like, the war on drugs to just the criminal legal system in general. I mean, since when you punish somebody, is it going to get them to do something differently in their lives, right? I take issue with that thinking generally. It's the same thinking that's led us into this housing crisis, which is like, oh, you can have a roof over your head maybe if you, like, drop the 40 that you've got in your hands. Who's going to do that if they're an alcoholic, right?
Right.
If you give them that choice and you'd be like, oh, I can give you this shelter, but you can't drink. It's like, well, you know, I'm going to get the DTs. I might die. Is it worth it? And in the moment when you're drinking, you're like, hell no, right?
Right.
So why is it that we're doing this whole kind of quid pro quo type form of legislating when we know that there's a moral imperative? I bet 9/10 of the people listening to this program right now, you know, if you actually ask them, do you think it's just to penalize people for this type of offense simply because they don't have an ability to pay, they'll be like, oh, well, I thought debtor's prison was illegal. Well, surprise, surprise, it's not. It's alive and well in Washington state. And while states like Mississippi have passed legal reforms to decriminalize this and end debt-based license suspensions, for some reason, we can't get it passed in any meaningful reform in our state. And ask yourself why that is.
I don't know, but I just got 4 emails marked urgent from some felt hat boomers, so...
right on.
Not all boomers. Not all boomers. Yeah,
hey, I want to give a shout out to the boomers on our team because there are a bunch of them, and they are doing really, really great work. And so I don't want to generalize too much. When I say boomers and use the term felt hat and stuff like that, it's all out of love. We need you. Ultimately, we need you, and we need you to act and to lobby your legislators because you have power. You have a lot more power than your average millennial and certainly a lot more power than your average a person of color. And I know that there's a lot of overlap between boomers and people of color, et cetera. But, you know, do it for all of us. Do it for the vulnerable people in your community and talk to your legislator. Call up Mike Chapman. Call up Kevin Vandewedge. Call up Steve Theringer and tell him enough is enough. Let's restore this bill to what it was to begin with when it was first introduced. Let's end debt-based driving suspensions and let's stop being this corner of Cascadia that refuses to act on this issue when all of our neighbors, including Idaho and Montana, my home state, have acted on this issue and ended debt-based driving suspensions. It's an embarrassment.
Mm. Thank you, Nat. Thanks so much for being here and talking about this. How can people get involved if they're feeling motivated after listening to you speak on this?
Well, call up your prosecutor, because he, whether he thinks he can or not, he has a wide amount of discretion on how this policy of criminalizing poverty is enforced in our area. And so, you know, call up James Kennedy. He's a nice guy. He'll listen to you. Write him an email. Tell him that this is an issue that's important to you. Tell him that he should not be spending prosecutorial resources on, you know, pulling people over for and prosecuting them for debt-based suspensions. Call up Joe Knoll, our sheriff. Tell him the same thing. Joe's a nice guy. He'll listen to you. Send him an email. Tell him that you don't want his officers pulling people over. They made over 300 arrests last year on this. You know, in Jefferson County, a county with a population of just over 30,000, there are hundreds and hundreds of people in our community that are impacted by this. And you can extrapolate that statewide, and now you're in the hundreds of thousands. And, you know, lobby your legislators, like I was saying before. Tell them that this is important to you. Tell them they're not going to be able to get away with this performative BS of claiming this moral high ground while allowing a bill to pass that has a collection agency-based amendment in it that's going to just serve to enrich collection interests and not, you know, at the expense of Washingtonians. And if you want to, contact me. I'm at Jefferson Associated Counsel. Look us up on the internet. We have a great website. Feel free to email us and email me and ask me any questions that you want to about the bill. I have tons and tons of resources that I can throw at you, whether you like it or not. And obviously, this is an issue that I'm very, very passionate about. So I thank you for your time and for having me on, Paul.
Of course.
And thanks for having Justine on earlier, too. She's awesome. She's devoted her life to these issues of anti-poverty and homelessness and underhomed individuals in our county. And so I want to give her a big shout out, too.
Well, thank you so much, Nat. And thanks for being here, and we'll do this again. Maybe we'll have some updates on getting rid of these restrictions and moving in a positive direction.
Great, thank you, Paul. I really appreciate you having me on, and I want to echo something Justine said. I was so sorry to hear about your mom, and we're with you, brother. We love you.
Thank you, Nat. Thank you. That means so much. And it's been amazing having a community's love behind me through all this. So I can't thank you enough. And I feel it.
Righteous.
Take care, brother.